a Germanic root, barrow, meaning the brown one, or the brown thing. In some Scandinavian languages, the word for bear derives from the phrase honey eaters. Many linguists believe these names are substitutes, created because speaking or writing the actual word for bear was considered taboo, as those in the wizarding world of Harry Potter were taught never to say Voldemort. Northern Europeans often did not say their actual word for bear, perhaps because it was believed saying the bear's true name could summon one. In any case, this taboo was so effective that today we are left with only the replacement word for bear. Essentially, we call them you-know-who. Even so, we've long posed a much greater threat to bears than they have to us. For centuries, Europeans tormented bears in a practice known as bear baiting. Bears would be chained to a pole and then attacked by dogs until they were injured or killed, or they'd be placed into a ring with a bull for a fight to the death. England's royals loved this stuff. Henry VIII had a bear pit made at the Palace of Whitehall. References to bear baiting even show up in Shakespeare, when Macbeth laments that his enemies have tied me to a stake. I cannot fly, but bear-like I must fight the course. This is an especially interesting passage, since by Shakespeare's time, bears had been extinct in Britain for perhaps 1,000 years, likely due to overhunting by humans. To fight the course bear-like couldn't refer to bear behaviors in the natural world, only to the violence bears suffered and meted out in a human-choreographed spectacle. Although plenty of people recognized bear baiting as a rude and dirty pastime, as the diarist John Evelyn put it, the objections to it weren't usually about animal cruelty. The Puritan hated bear baiting, not because it gave pain to the bear, but because it gave pleasure to the spectators, wrote Thomas Babington Macaulay. It would be inaccurate, then, to claim our dominion over bears is a wholly recent phenomenon. Still, it's a bit odd that our children now commonly cuddle with a stuffed version of an animal we used to be afraid to call by name. Here's the story of the teddy bear as it is usually told. In November of 1902, U.S. President Teddy Roosevelt went bear hunting in Mississippi, which was an extremely Teddy Roosevelt thing to do. The hunting party's dogs chased a bear for hours before Roosevelt gave up and returned to camp for lunch. Roosevelt's hunting guide that day, a man named Holt Collier, continued to track the bear with his dogs as the president ate lunch. Collier had been born enslaved in Mississippi, and after emancipation, he became one of the world's most accomplished horse riders. He also killed over 3,000 bears in his lifetime. While Roosevelt was away, Collier's dogs cornered the bear. Collier blew a bugle to alert the president, but before Roosevelt returned, Collier had to club the bear with a rifle butt because it was mauling one of his dogs. By the time the president arrived on the scene, the bear was tied to a tree and semi-conscious. Roosevelt refused to shoot it, feeling it would be unsportsmanlike. Word of the president's compassion spread throughout the country, especially after a cartoon in the Washington Post by Clifford Berryman illustrated the event. In the cartoon, the bear is reimagined as an innocent cub with a round face and large eyes, looking toward Roosevelt with meek desperation. Morris and Rose Meachtom, Russian immigrants living in Brooklyn, saw that cartoon and were inspired to create a stuffed version of the cartoon cub they called Teddy's Bear. The bear was placed in the window of their candy shop and became an immediate hit. Curiously, a German firm independently produced a similar teddy bear around the same time, and both companies ended up becoming hugely successful. The German manufacturer Steiff had been founded a couple decades earlier by Margaret Steiff, and her nephew Richard designed the Steiff teddy bear, By 1907, they were selling nearly a million of them per year. That same year, back in Brooklyn, the Meachtums used their teddy bear sales to found the company Ideal Toys, which went on to manufacture a huge array of 20th century playthings, from the game Mousetrap to the Rubik's Cube. The typical contemporary teddy bear looks approximately like the 1902 ones did. Brown body, dark eyes, a round face, a cute little nose. When I was a kid, a talking teddy bear named Teddy Ruxpin became popular. But what I loved about teddy bears was their silence. They didn't ask anything of me or judge me for my emotional outbursts. One of my most vivid childhood memories is of my 10th birthday. I retreated to my room after an exhausting party and cuddled up with a teddy bear. But I found that it didn't really work anymore, that whatever had once soothed me about this soft and silent creature no longer did. I remember thinking that I would never be a kid again, not really, which was the first time I can remember feeling that intense longing for the you to whom you can never return. Sarah Dessen once wrote that home is not a place, but a moment. Home is a teddy bear, but only a certain teddy bear at a certain time. The bears of our imagination have become increasingly sweet and cuddly since the debut of the teddy bear. Winnie the Pooh first arrived in 1926, Paddington Bear in 1958. The Care Bears showed up in 1981 as the ultimate unthreatening ursine friends. Characters like Funshine Bear and Love-A-Lot Bear starred in aggressively saccharine picture books with titles like Caring is What Counts and Your Best Wishes Can Come True. In the broader world, at least those of us living in cities began to see bears as we thought Roosevelt had seen them. Creatures to be pitied and preserved. If I forget to turn off the lights when leaving a room, my daughter will often shout, "Dad, the polar bears!" because she's been taught that minimizing our electricity usage can shrink our carbon footprint and thereby preserve the habitat of polar bears. She's not afraid of polar bears. She's afraid of their extinction. The animals that once terrorized us and that we long terrorized, are now often viewed as weak and vulnerable. The mighty bear has become, like so many creatures on Earth, dependent upon us. Their survival is contingent upon our wisdom and compassion, just as that bear in Mississippi needed Roosevelt to be kind. In that sense, the teddy bear is a reminder of the astonishing power of contemporary humanity. It's hard to understand how dominant our species has become, but I sometimes find it helpful to consider it purely in terms of mass. The total combined weight of all living humans currently on Earth is around 385 million tons. That's the so-called biomass of our species. The biomass of our livestock, sheep, chickens, cows, and so on, is around 800 million tons. And the combined biomass of every other mammal and bird on Earth is less than 100 million tons. All the whales and tigers and monkeys and deer and bears and, yes, even Canada geese, together, they weigh less than a third of what we weigh. Side note, we are all dwarfed by bacteria, though. According to one recent estimate, the biomass of bacteria is about 35 times larger than the combined biomass of all animals. For many species of large animals in the 21st century, the single most important determinant of survival is whether their existence is useful to humans. But if you can't be of utility to people, the second best thing you can be is cute. You need an expressive face, ideally some large eyes. Your babies need to remind us of our babies. Something about you must make us feel guilty for eliminating you from the planet. Can cuteness save a species? I'm dubious. The part of the teddy bear origin story that often doesn't get told is that right after Roosevelt sportingly refused to kill the bear, he ordered a member of his hunting party to slit its throat so as to put the bear out of its misery. No bears were saved that day, and now there are fewer than 50 bears left in Mississippi. Global sales of teddy bears, meanwhile, have never been higher. I give the teddy bear 2.5 stars. The Hall of Presidents. I grew up in Orlando, Florida, about 15 miles away from the world's most visited theme park, Walt Disney World's Magic Kingdom. When I was a kid, Orlando was such a tourist city that whenever you flew out of the airport, a message played saying, "We hope you enjoyed your visit." In response, my parents would always sigh and then mutter, "We live here." I first visited the Magic Kingdom in 1981, when I was 4 and it was 10. I loved the park back then. I remember meeting Goofy and allowing myself to believe it was actually Goofy. I remember getting scared on the Snow White ride and feeling big because I could ride Thunder Mountain. And I remember being so tired at the end of the day that I'd fall asleep with my face pressed against the glass of our Volkswagen Rabbit. But then I got older. As a teenager, I began to define myself primarily by what I disliked, and my loathes were legion. I hated children's books, the music of Mariah Carey, suburban architecture, shopping malls, but most of all, I hated Disney World. My friends and I had a word for the artificiality and corporatized fantasy of pop music and theme parks and cheerful movies. We called all of it plastic. The TV show Full House was plastic. The Cure's new stuff was kind of plastic. And Disney World? God, Disney World was so plastic. This period of my life coincided with a terrible blessing. My mother won a community service award, and the award came with 4 free annual passes to Disney. That summer, I was 14, and my family dragged me to Disney World all the time. I realize I'm probably not garnering much sympathy with my sorrowful tale of getting into Disney World for free dozens of times in one summer, but 14-year-old me hated it. For one thing, Disney World was always hot, and in 1992, I had a semi-religious allegiance to wearing a trench coat, which did not pair well with the pounding and oppressive swamp heat of Central Florida summers. The coat was meant to protect me from the world, not the weather, and in that respect, it succeeded. Still, I was always sweating, and I must have been quite a sight to my fellow theme park visitors, a rail-thin child with a hunter green coat to my knees, droplets of sweat erupting from every facial pore. But, of course, I wanted those people to be freaked out by me, because I was freaked out by them. I was repulsed by the idea that they were giving money to a corporation in order to escape their horrible, miserable lives that were horrible and miserable in part because our corporate overlords controlled all the means of production. At any rate, I had to survive many long summer days at Disney World. I usually started out sitting on a bench near the entrance to the park, scrawling snippets of stories into a yellow legal pad, and then eventually the day would get unbearably warm, and I'd make my way to the Hall of Presidents, which was one of the least crowded and best air-conditioned attractions at the Magic Kingdom. For the remainder of the day, I'd return to the Hall of Presidents show over and over, writing in that legal pad all the while. I began the first short story I ever finished while sitting through the Hall of Presidents show, The story was about a crazed anthropologist who kidnaps a family of hunter-gatherers and takes them to Disney World. Side note, I lost this story shortly after finishing it, and in my memory, the story had real promise. For many years, I believed that if I could just find that story, I would discover that my next book was already half written, and I'd only need to tighten up the plot a little and expand a few of the characters. And then, a few years back, my dad found a copy of the story and sent it to me. And of course, it is terrible and lacks a single redeeming quality. The Hall of Presidents was an opening day attraction at the Magic Kingdom, and it has been a constant presence since the park opened in 1971. In a building modeled after Independence Hall in Philadelphia, where the U.S. Constitution was debated, visitors first enter a waiting room, which features busts of several presidents and also a bust of the Disney Company's founder, Walt Disney, who is identified as an American original. Since there is almost never a wait for the Hall of Presidents, you soon enter the main theater, whereupon you are told that the attraction is dedicated to the memory of Walt Disney. This always struck me as a bit excessive, not only because Disney's sculpted head appears in the waiting room, but also because the entire park is named after him? Anyway, after Disney thanks Disney, there's a movie about American history before the screen eventually ascends to reveal the stars of the show, life-size animatronic recreations of every American president. The animatronics are at once creepily lifelike and terrifyingly robotic, a proper descent into the uncanny valley. As my daughter, then 4 years old, said when we visited the Hall of Presidents, "Those are not humans." Only a couple of the presidents actually speak. Animatronic Abraham Lincoln stands and recites the Gettysburg Address, and since the early 1990s, the animatronic current president has made a speech at the end of the show, using their own voice. When we visited in 2018, animatronic Donald Trump uttered a few sentences, including, "Above all, to be an American is to be an optimist," which is just a fundamental misunderstanding of how citizenship gets conferred in nation states. The Hall of Presidents doesn't ignore the various horrors of American history, but it's also an unapologetically patriotic celebration of the United States and its presidents. In fact, one of the last lines of the show is, "Our presidency is no longer just an idea. It is an idea with a proud history." And I would argue it is an idea with a proud history, but it is also an idea with many other histories, a shameful history, an oppressive history, and a violent history, among others. One of the challenges of contemporary life for me is determining how those histories can coexist without negating each other. But the Hall of Presidents doesn't really ask them to coexist. Instead, it imagines a triumphalist view of American history. Sure, we had some failures, but thankfully we solved them with our relentless optimism, and just look at us now. Two of the Anthropocene's major institutions are the nation-state and the limited liability corporation, both of which are real and powerful, and on some level made up. The United States isn't real the way a river is real, nor is the Walt Disney Company. They are both ideas we believe in. Yes, the United States has laws and treaties and a constitution and so on, but none of that prevents a country from splitting apart or even disappearing. From the neoclassical architecture that attempts to give the U.S. a sense of permanence to the faces on our money, America has to continually convince its citizens that it is real and good and worthy of allegiance. Which is not so different from the work that the Walt Disney Company tries to do by revering its founding father and focusing on its rich history. Both the nation and the corporation can only exist if at least some people believe in them. And in that sense, they really are kinds of magic kingdoms. As a teen, I liked to imagine what might happen if we all stopped believing in these constructs. What would happen if we abandoned the idea of the U.S. Constitution being the ruling document of our nation, or the idea of nation-states altogether? Perhaps it's a symptom of middle age that I now want to imagine better nation-states and better regulated private corporations rather than leaving behind these ideas. But we cannot do the hard work of imagining a better world into existence unless we reckon honestly with what governments and corporations want us to believe and why they want us to believe it. Until then, the Hall of Presidents will always feel a little plastic to me. I give it 2 stars. Air conditioning. Over the last 100 years, the weather for humans has gotten considerably hotter, not just because of global warming, but also because of where we are choosing to live. In the United States, for instance, the 3 states with the largest population gains in the past century, Nevada, Florida, and Arizona, are also among the warmest states. This trend is perhaps best exemplified by the U.S.'s 5th largest city, Phoenix, Arizona, which had a population of 5,544 people in 1900. In 2021, Phoenix was home to around 1.7 million people. The average high temperature in August is 103 degrees Fahrenheit, and yet they have a professional ice hockey team, the Arizona Coyotes. Until 1996, the Coyotes were known as the Jets, and they were based in Winnipeg, Manitoba, where the weather is considerably cooler, but the NHL followed the money and the people toward the equator. One of the reasons for this huge shift in human geography is the miracle of air conditioning, which allows people to control the temperature of their interior spaces. Air conditioning has deeply reshaped human life in rich countries, from small things like the declining percentage of time that windows are open in buildings, to large things like the availability of medication, insulin, many antibiotics, nitroglycerin, and lots of other drugs are heat sensitive and can lose their efficacy if not stored at so-called room temperature, which is defined as between 68 and 77 degrees Fahrenheit, temperatures that no room in summertime Phoenix could have hoped to achieve before air conditioning. Climate-controlled drug storage remains one of the big challenges for healthcare systems in poor countries where many health facilities have no electricity. Even the experience you're having right now is contingent upon air conditioning. This audiobook either currently lives or else once did inside the cloud, which is not really a cloud. It is a huge array of linked servers that almost never overheat or corrode because they are kept artificially dry and cool via air conditioning. Like so much else in the Anthropocene, air conditioning has a relatively recent history. In 1902, a young engineer named Willis Carrier was tasked with solving a problem in Buffalo, New York. A printing company's magazine pages were warping due to summertime humidity. Carrier created a device that essentially reversed the process of electric heating, running air through cold coils instead of hot ones. This reduced humidity, but it also had the useful side effect of decreasing indoor temperatures. Carrier went on to make many inquiries into what he called treating air, and the company he co-founded, the Carrier Corporation, remains one of the largest air conditioning manufacturers in the world. Heat has long been a worry for humans. In ancient Egypt, houses were cooled by hanging reeds from windows and trickling water down them. Then, as now, controlling indoor temperatures wasn't only about comfort and convenience, because heat can kill humans. In an essay with the catchy title, An Account of the Extraordinary Heat of the Weather in July 1757 and the Effects of It, The English physician John Huxham wrote that heat caused, quote, sudden and violent pains of the head and vertigo, profuse sweats, great debility, and depression of the spirits. He also noted that the urine of heat wave victims was, quote, high-colored and in small quantity. In many countries today, including the United States, heat waves cause more deaths than lightning, tornadoes, hurricanes, floods, and earthquakes combined. A 2003 European heat wave that was concentrated in France led to the deaths of over 70,000 people. Deadly heat waves from Australia to Algeria and from Canada to Argentina have been common throughout history. But one of the weirdnesses of the Anthropocene is that in the wealthier parts of the world, heat is now more of a health problem in mild climates than in hot ones. Over the past 20 years, people living in usually cool central France, where home AC is uncommon, have been far more likely to die from heat waves than people living in usually sweltering Phoenix, where over 90% of households have at least some form of air conditioning. There's another peculiarity of modern air conditioning. Cooling the indoors warms the outdoors. Most of the energy that powers air conditioning systems comes from fossil fuels, the use of which warms the planet, which over time will necessitate more and more conditioning of air. According to the International Energy Agency, air conditioning and electric fans combined already account for around 10% of all global electricity usage, and they expect AC usage will more than triple over the next 30 years. And like most other energy-intensive innovations, AC primarily benefits people in rich communities, while the consequences of climate change are borne disproportionately by people in impoverished communities. Climate change is probably the biggest shared challenge facing 21st century humans, and I fear future generations will judge us harshly for our failure to do much about it. They will likely learn in their history classes correctly that as a species, we knew carbon emissions were affecting the planet's climate back in the 1970s, and they will learn correctly about the efforts in the 1980s and 1990s to limit carbon emissions, efforts that ultimately failed for complicated and multifaceted reasons that I assume the history classes of the future will have successfully boiled down into a single narrative. And I suspect that our choices will seem unforgivable and even unfathomable to the people reading those history books. It is fortunate, Charles Dudley Warner wrote more than a century ago, that each generation does not comprehend its own ignorance. We are thus enabled to call our ancestors barbarous. Warner is remembered for one other quote, incidentally. He was the first person known to make a version of the joke, "Everybody talks about the weather, but nobody ever does anything about it." But of course, we are doing something about the weather. Even as we begin to experience the consequences of climate change, we are struggling to mount a global human response to this global problem caused by humans. Some of that is down to public misinformation and the widespread distrust of expertise. Some of it is because climate change feels like an important problem, but not an urgent one. The wildfires that have become more common must be put out today. It is much harder for us to make the big changes that would, over generations, decrease the probability of those fires. But I think it is also hard for us to confront human-caused climate change because the most privileged among us, the people who consume the most energy, can separate ourselves from the weather. I am certainly one such person. I am insulated from the weather by my house and its conditioned air. I eat strawberries in January. When it is raining, I can go inside. When it is dark, I can turn on lights. It is easy for me to feel like climate is mostly an outside phenomenon, whereas I am mostly an inside phenomenon. But that's all a misconception. I am utterly, wholly dependent on what I imagine as the outside world. I am contingent upon it. For humans, there is ultimately no way out of the obligations and limitations of nature. We are nature. And so, like history, the climate is both something that happens to us and something we make. Here in Indianapolis, high temperatures reach above 90 degrees Fahrenheit only about 13 days per year, and yet most of our homes and office buildings are air-conditioned. This is in part because architecture has changed dramatically in the last 50 years, especially when it comes to commercial buildings, to assume the existence of air conditioning. But AC is also becoming more common because more of us expect to be able to control our interior environments. When I'm outside, if I can adjust my wardrobe a bit, I can feel entirely comfortable if the temperature is anywhere between 55 and 85 degrees Fahrenheit. But inside, my comfort zone drops dramatically, down to a couple of degrees. I loathe sweating while sitting inside, as I often did when I lived in an unair-conditioned apartment in Chicago. I find it equally uncomfortable to feel goosebumps of chill indoors. Like an expensive painting or a fragile orchid, I thrive only in extremely specific conditions. I am not alone in this respect. A Cornell University study in 2004 found that office temperatures affect workplace productivity. When temperatures were increased from 68 degrees Fahrenheit to 77, typing output rose by 150% and error frequency dropped by 44%. This is no small matter. The author of the study said it suggested raising the temperature to a more comfortable thermal zone saves employers about $2 per worker per hour. Why then are so many summertime office environments so cool when it is both more expensive and less efficient to keep summertime temperatures low? Perhaps because the definition of room temperature has historically been established by analyzing the temperature preferences of 40-year-old 154-pound men wearing business suits. Studies have consistently found that, on average, women prefer warmer indoor temperatures. But when people point out the bias of AC settings in office buildings, especially when women point it out, they've often been mocked for being overly sensitive. After the journalist Taylor Lorenz tweeted that office air conditioning systems are sexist, a blog in The Atlantic wrote, "To think the temperature in a building is sexist is absurd." But it's not absurd. What's absurd is reducing workplace productivity by using precious fossil fuels to excessively cool an office building so that men wearing ornamental jackets will feel more comfortable. I need to get used to feeling a bit warmer. It's the only future for us. When I was a kid in Florida, it seemed natural to me to grab a sweatshirt before heading to the movie theater. Air conditioning, like so much else in the Anthropocene, was a kind of background hum that reshaped my life without my ever thinking about it. But writing to you from the early hours of 2021, entering a movie theater at all feels wildly unnatural. What's natural for humans is always changing. I am immensely grateful for air conditioning. It makes human life far better. But we need to broaden our definition of what constitutes climate control, and quickly. I give air conditioning 3 stars. Staphylococcus aureus. Years ago, I acquired an infection in my left eye socket caused by the bacteria Staphylococcus aureus. My vision clouded and my eye swelled shut. I ended up hospitalized for over a week. Had I experienced the same infection any time in history before 1940, I would have likely lost not just my eye, but my life. Then again, I probably wouldn't have lived long enough to acquire orbital cellulitis because I would have died of the staph infections I had in childhood. When I was in the hospital, the infectious disease doctors made me feel very special. One told me, "You are colonized by some fascinatingly aggressive staph." Only about 20% of humans are persistently colonized with Staphylococcus aureus. The precise reasons why are not yet clear, and I am apparently one of them. Those of us who carry the bacteria all the time are more likely to experience staph infections. After marveling at my particular staph colony, the doctor told me I wouldn't believe the petri dishes if I saw them, and then called my continued existence a real testament to modern medicine. Which I suppose it is. For people like myself, colonized by fascinatingly aggressive bacteria, there can be no hearkening back wistfully to past golden ages, because in all those pasts, I would be thoroughly dead. In 1941, Boston City Hospital reported an 82% fatality rate for staph infections. I remember as a child hearing phrases like "only the strong survive" and "survival of the fittest," and feeling terrified because I knew I was neither strong nor fit. I didn't yet understand that when humanity protects the frail among us and works to ensure their survival, the human project as a whole gets stronger. Because staph often infects open wounds, it has been especially deadly during war. Near the beginning of World War I, the English poet Rupert Brooke famously wrote, "If I should die, think only this of me, that there's some corner of a foreign field that is forever England." Brooke would indeed die in the war, in the winter of 1915, not in some corner of a foreign field, but on a hospital boat, where he was killed by a bacterial infection. By then, there were thousands of doctors treating the war's wounded and ill. Among them was a 71-year-old Scottish surgeon, Alexander Ogston, who decades earlier had discovered and named Staphylococcus. Ogston was a huge fan of Joseph Lister, whose observations about post-surgical infection led to the use of carbolic acid and other sterilization techniques. These drastically increased surgical survival rates. Ogston wrote to Lister in 1883, "You have changed surgery from being a hazardous lottery into a safe and soundly based science," which was only a bit of an exaggeration. Before antiseptics, Ogston wrote, "After every operation, we used to await with trembling the dreaded third day when sepsis set in." One of Ogston's colleagues, a nurse who worked with him at the Aberdeen Royal Infirmary, declined surgery for a strangulated hernia, choosing death, for she had never seen a case which was operated on recover. After visiting Lister and observing complex knee surgeries healing without infection, Ogston returned to the hospital in Aberdeen and tore down the sign above the operating room that read, "Prepare to meet thy God." No longer would surgery be a last-ditch, desperate effort. Ogston was so obsessed with Lister's carbolic acid spray that his students wrote a poem about it, which read in part, "And we learned the thing of the future was using unlimited spray. The spray, the spray, the antiseptic spray. AO would shower it morning, night, and day for every sort of scratch where others would attach a sticking plaster patch. He gave the spray." Ogston's first wife, Mary Jane, died after childbirth a few years before these revelations, at the age of 25. There's no record of her cause of death, but most maternal deaths at the time were caused by postpartum infection, often due to Staphylococcus aureus. And Ogston had seen hundreds of his patients die of post-surgical infection. No wonder, then, that he was obsessed with antiseptic protocols. Still, he wanted to understand not just how to prevent infection, but also what precisely was causing it. By the late 1870s, many discoveries were being made by surgeons and researchers about various bacteria and their role in infection, but Staphylococcus was not identified until Augustin lanced a pus-filled, abscessed leg wound belonging to one James Davidson. Under the microscope, Davidson's abscess was brimming with life. Augustin wrote, "My delight may be conceived when there were revealed to me beautiful tangles, tufts, and chains of round organisms in great numbers." Augustin named these tufts and chains Staphylococcus, from the Greek word for bunches of grapes. And they do often look like grape bunches, plump spheres gathered together in tight clusters. But Augustin wasn't content with just seeing bacteria. "Obviously," he wrote, "the first step to be taken was to make sure the organisms found in Mr. Davidson's pus were not there by chance." So Augustin set up a laboratory in the shed behind his home and began trying to grow colonies of staph, eventually succeeding by using a chicken egg as the medium. He then injected the bacteria into guinea pigs and mice, which became violently ill. Augustin also noted that Staphylococcus seemed to be, quote, "harmless on the surface, despite being, quote, so deleterious when injected." "I have also observed this, insofar as I am not much bothered by having my skin colonized by Staphylococcus aureus, but find it deleterious indeed when it starts replicating inside my eye socket." James Davidson, by the way, went on to live for many decades after his staph infection, thanks to a thorough debriding and Augustin's liberal use of the antiseptic spray. But Staphylococcus aureus remained an exceptionally dangerous infection until another Scottish scientist, Alexander Fleming, discovered penicillin by accident. One Monday morning in 1928, Fleming noticed that one of his cultures of Staphylococcus aureus had been contaminated by a fungus, Penicillium, which seemed to have killed all the staph bacteria. He remarked aloud, "That's funny." Fleming used what he called his mold juice to treat a couple of patients, including curing his assistant's sinus infection. But mass production of the antibiotic substance secreted by penicillium proved quite challenging. It wasn't until the late 1930s that a group of scientists at Oxford began testing their penicillin stocks, first on mice, and then in 1941 on a human subject, a policeman named Albert Alexander. After being cut by shrapnel during a German bombing raid, Alexander was dying of bacterial infections, in his case, both Staphylococcus aureus and Streptococcus. The penicillin caused a dramatic improvement in Alexander's condition, but the researchers didn't have enough of the drug to save him. The infection returned, and Alexander died in April of 1941. His 7-year-old daughter, Sheila, ended up in a local orphanage. Scientists sought out more productive strains of the mold, and eventually, the bacteriologist Mary Hunt found one on a cantaloupe in a Peoria, Illinois grocery store. That strain became even more productive after being exposed to X-rays and ultraviolet radiation. Essentially, all the penicillin in the world descends from the mold on that one cantaloupe in Peoria. That's not the astonishing thing about the story, though. The astonishing thing is that after scraping off the mold that became the world's penicillin supply, the researchers ate the rest of the cantaloupe. Even as penicillin stocks increased from 21 billion units in 1943 to 6.8 trillion units in 1945, there was growing awareness that the bacteria killed by penicillin were evolving resistance to it, especially Staphylococcus aureus. A 1946 Saturday Evening Post article worried that antibiotic use would, quote, unwittingly aid and speed up the subtle evolution forces which arrange for the survival of the fittest microbes. So it was to be. By 1950, 40% of Staphylococcus aureus samples in hospitals were resistant to penicillin. By 1960, 80%. Today, only around 2% of Staphylococcus aureus infections are sensitive to penicillin. This all happened so quickly. 64 years elapsed between Alexander Ogston's discovery of Staphylococcus and the mass production of penicillin, and 64 years elapsed between the mass production of penicillin and my 2007 bout with orbital cellulitis. In the end, my infection did not respond to penicillin or to the next two lines of antibiotics, but did fortunately respond to the fourth. Antibiotic resistance is not a problem for the future. This year, some 50,000 people in the U.S. will die of Staphylococcus aureus infections. How recent is penicillin? That police officer's daughter, who ended up in the orphanage, is still alive as of this recording. Sheila Alexander married an American soldier and moved to California. She's a painter. One of her recent paintings depicts a block of homes in an English village. Ivy grows up along the wall of one home, creeping over rough stone. To me, one of the mysteries of life is why life wants to be. Life is so much more biochemical work than chemical equilibrium, but still, staff desperately seeks that work. As do I, come to think of it. Staphylococcus doesn't want to harm people. It doesn't know about people. It just wants to be. Like I want to go on. Like that ivy wants to spread across the wall, occupying more and more of it. How much? As much as it can. It's not staff's fault that it wants to be. Nonetheless, I give Staphylococcus aureus 1 star. The Internet. When the Internet first came to our house in the early 1990s, so far as I could tell, the Internet was inside of a box. The box required a bunch of technical skill to install. And then, once my dad got the internet working, the internet was green letters on a black screen. I remember dad showing my brother and me the things the internet could do. "Look," he would say, "the internet can show you what the weather is like right now in Beijing." Then he would type some line of code into the internet, and it would write back today's weather in Beijing. "Or," he would say excitedly, "you can download the entire Apology of Socrates for free and read it right here in the house." To my dad, this must have seemed like an actual miracle. But I was not a fan. For one thing, we couldn't get phone calls while my dad was online on account of how the internet used the phone line. Admittedly, 14-year-old me wasn't fielding a ton of calls, but still. More than that, it seemed to me that the internet was primarily a forum for talking about the internet. My dad would read and tell us about endless user manuals and message boards he'd read, about how the internet worked and what it might be able to do in the future, and so on. One day, dad showed me that on the internet, you could talk to real people all over the world. He explained, "You can practice your French by going to a French forum," and he showed me how it worked. I messaged a couple people on the forum, "Comment ça va?" They responded in real time, with real French, which was unfortunate as I didn't know much French. I started wondering if there might be an English language version of the service, and it turned out there was. In fact, there was one built just for me. The CompuServe Teen Forum. On the CompuServe Teen Forum, nobody knew anything about me. They didn't know that I was a miserable, cringingly awkward kid whose voice often creaked with nervousness. They didn't know I was late to puberty, and they didn't know the names people called me at school. And paradoxically, because they didn't know me, they knew me far better than anyone in my real life. I remember one evening, in an instant message conversation, I told my CompuServe friend Marie about the night feeling. The night feeling was my private name for the wave that crashed over me most school nights when I got into bed. My stomach would tighten, and I'd feel the worry radiating out from my belly button. I'd never told anyone about the night feeling, and my heart was racing as I typed. Marie responded that she also knew the night feeling, and that she sometimes found comfort in listening quietly to her clock radio. I tried that, and it helped. But most of the time, my teen forum friend group did not share our secrets. We shared inside jokes and learned and built and borrowed and created together. By the summer of 1993, the CompuServe teen forum was a vast universe of mythology and references, from jokes about the TV show Barney and Friends to endless acronyms and abbreviations. The internet was still just green letters on a black screen, so we couldn't use images, but we arranged text characters into shapes. The idea of ASCII art, as it is known, had been around for decades, but we hadn't been around for decades, and so we felt like we were discovering it as we built everything from extremely simple images, like smiley faces, for example, to ridiculously complex and often obscene ones. I don't recall using a word to describe what we were doing, but these days we would call this stuff memes. That summer, with school out of the way, I was able to devote myself full-time to the teen forum. I even got something called an email address, a series of randomly generated digits at CompuServe.com. Back then, the internet charged by the hour, which became a real issue because I wanted to spend every hour on it. Now it was my parents who complained about the phone line being tied up. They loved that I was making friends, that I was writing and reading so much, but they could not afford a $100 monthly internet bill. At this point, a lifeline appeared when I was hired as a moderator for the teen forum. The payment came in the form of all the free internet I wanted, and I wanted a lot of it. CompuServe even paid for a separate phone line so I could be online constantly. If a single event in my life occurred outdoors that summer, I do not recall it. I fear I've been romanticizing. The early 90s internet had many of the problems the current internet does. While I recall the teen forum being well moderated, the same racism and misogyny that populate today's comment sections was prevalent 30 years ago. And then, as now, you could fall very far down the rabbit hole of the internet's highly personalized information feeds until conspiracy theories began to feel more real than so-called facts. I lived this experience, actually. In the early 90s, I became entranced by something called the Phantom Time Hypothesis, which held that around 300 years of time between the 7th and 10th centuries never actually happened and were instead invented by the Catholic Church. I was originally turned on to this idea by one of those memes that is itself not sure whether it's ironic. The conspiracy theory, which was pretty widespread at the time, held that I was really living not in the year 1993, but instead around 1698, and that a bunch of years had been faked so that the church could maintain power. The details of it escape me, but it is amazing what you can believe when you are down the rabbit hole. I have wonderful memories of that summer, and also traumatic ones. A few years ago, I ran into an old friend who said of our high school, "It saved my life, but it also did lots of other things. So too with the internet. These days, after drinking from the internet's fire hose for 30 years, I've begun to feel more of those negative effects. I don't know if it's my age or the fact that the internet is no longer plugged into the wall and now travels with me everywhere I go, but I find myself thinking of that Wordsworth poem that begins, "The world is too much with us, late and soon." What does it say that I can't imagine my life or my work without the internet? What does it mean to have my way of thinking and my way of being so profoundly shaped by machine logic? What does it mean that having been part of the internet for so long, the internet is also part of me? My friend Stan Muller tells me that when you're living in the middle of history, you never know what it means. I am living in the middle of the internet. I have no idea what it means. I give the internet 3 stars. Academic decathlon. Beginning in 10th grade, I attended a boarding school in Alabama, where my best friend Todd was also my roommate. He would often say that late at night, when he was trying to fall asleep in our air-conditionless dorm room, I turned into a stream-of-consciousness novel. I'd tell him everything, my every interaction with my English class crush, including selected quotations from the notes she and I exchanged, the reasons it just wasn't possible for me to turn in the paper I had due for history, the weird ache I always felt on the outside of my left knee, how nervous I'd been smoking a cigarette behind the gym because someone got caught there last week, and on and on and on until finally he would say, "Seriously, Green, I love you, but I have to sleep." We were not afraid to say "I love you" to each other. Here's my favorite story about Todd. In those days, the SAT was offered only every other month in Alabama. Todd and I managed to miss the last local SAT test before our college application deadlines, so we had to drive to Georgia to take the test. After a road trip and a night in a Motel 6, we arrived bleary-eyed at the testing site, where I struggled to concentrate for 4 endless hours. When the test was at last over, I met back up with Todd. The first thing he said to me was, "What's ostentatious mean?" And I told him it meant like showy or over the top. Todd nodded subtly to himself, and then, after a second, said, "Cool, I got them all then." And he had. Perfect score on the SAT. It was Todd who had the idea for me to join the academic decathlon team, although at first blush I seemed a poor candidate. I never excelled academically and took some pride in not fulfilling my potential, in part because I was terrified that if I tried my hardest, the world would learn I didn't actually have that much potential. But in my poor grades, Todd sensed an opportunity. Academic decathlon, sometimes known as ACADEC, features 10 disciplines. In 1994, there were 7 objective events featuring multiple choice tests: economics, fine arts, language and literature, math, science, social science, and a super quiz in Documents of Freedom. There were also 3 subjective events graded by judges: an essay, an in-person interview, and the performance of a speech. Every school's ACADEC team has 9 players. You get 3 A students with grade point averages above 3.75, 3 B students with GPAs above 3, and 3 C students whose GPAs are 2.99 or below. For all you non-Americans out there, that means 3 of each school's players get excellent marks, 3 get good ones, and 3 must be fairly bad at school. I, as it happened, was terrible at school. Todd believed that with his patient instruction and my awful grades, he could mold me into an academic decathlon superstar. And so beginning in our junior year, we studied together. We read an entire economics textbook, and whenever I found part of it inscrutable, Todd would frame the topic in ways that were comprehensible to me. When we were learning about marginal utility, for example, he explained it to me in terms of Zima. Todd would tell me, look, you drink one Zima and you feel good. You drink two and you feel better, but the added benefit is smaller than between zero and one. The additional usefulness of each added Zima gets lower and lower until eventually the curve inverts around five Zimas and you throw up. That's marginal utility. Side note, Zima was an alcoholic beverage that was kind of a low-quality precursor to 21st-century hard seltzer. It was terrible, and I loved it. More importantly, many years later, I would hear marginal utility described almost exactly the same way on the NPR podcast Planet Money. Did that podcast and Todd have a shared source, or is my memory being unreliable? I don't know. What I do know is that my marginal utility curve still inverts after five drinks, just as it did in high school. So we learned economics, but we also learned art history and chemistry and math and much else. Through studying for academic decathlon, I learned about everything from the Indus Valley civilization to mitosis. And thanks to Todd, I became a very capable academic decathlete. I don't want to brag, but at the Alabama State Academic Decathlon of 1994, I was the Lionel Messi of C students. I won 7 medals, 4 of them gold, out of a possible 10 events. I won a bronze medal in math, even though that year I received a D in pre-calc. Admittedly, none of my scores would have gotten me into the top 10 among A or B students, but I wasn't competing against them. For the first time in my academic life, I felt like I wasn't an idiot. I won gold medals in topics I thought I sucked at, like literature and history, and also won in speech, which was especially surprising because I'd always been a poor public speaker. I hated my voice, the way it betrayed my omnidirectional anxiety, and I'd done terribly in debate competitions. But with Acadec, I'd found a place where I could flourish. Our school won the state competition, which meant we'd qualified for nationals to be held that year in a hotel ballroom in Newark, New Jersey. Over the next few months, my growing academic confidence, combined with study skills learned from Todd, meant that my grades started to improve. I was briefly at risk of losing my coveted C student status until I realized I could tank physics to keep my GPA below 3. That April, the 9 of us and our coaches flew up to Newark. We made friends with other nerds from around the country, including a C student from the Midwest whose name was, I think, Caroline. She had a good fake ID and managed to smuggle a 12-pack of Zimas to us. Todd was one of the leading A students at Nationals, and our little team from Alabama ended up finishing 6th in the nation. I even won a couple of medals. One was in speech. My speech was about rivers. I don't remember much about it, but I think I talked about meanders, the serpentine bends in a river's course. I've loved rivers ever since I can remember. I spent part of one summer with my dad on the Noatak River in northern Alaska, and another paddling the French Broad River in Tennessee. The idea for the speech was stolen from Todd. We were sitting on the banks of a creek one September afternoon, the air thick and mosquito-laden, and Todd told me that what he liked about rivers was that they keep going. They meander this way and that, but they keep going. It's April of 2020. I am a long way downstream from that hotel ballroom in Newark. All morning, I've been trying to help my kids with e-learning, but I worry I only make it worse for them with my impatience and exasperation. I'm stressed about work, even though my work is absurdly inessential. At noon, the Indiana State Department of Health updates its COVID-19 dashboard, with grim news. As the kids eat lunch, I read the updates on my phone. Sarah comes downstairs, and we go to the living room so that she can tell me about a friend of ours who is hospitalized. The news is good. Our friend is recovering. But I can't feel any joy about it. There is only dread. She can see it in me, I think, because she says, "Why don't you walk over to the river?" These days, I can only feel normal when I'm outside. I am writing this now on the west bank of the White River here in Indianapolis. I brought a camping chair down here. I'm sitting atop a grassy berm, and my laptop's battery has plenty of power. Before me, the river is a muddy, flooded cacophony. Every minute or two, an uprooted tree comes barreling downriver. In a dry summer, I can walk across this stretch of river without ever getting my shorts wet. But now, it's 15 feet deep and churning. For days now, my brain has refused to allow me to finish a thought, constantly interrupting with worries. Even my worries get interrupted by new worries or facets of old worries I had not adequately considered. My thoughts are a river overflowing its banks, churning and muddy and ceaseless. I wish I wasn't so scared all the time. Scared of the virus, yes. But there is also some deeper fear, the terror of time passing, and me with it. I brought a Terry Tempest Williams book with me, but the omnipresent worry makes it impossible to read for more than a few minutes. Scanning through the book, I find a passage I highlighted years ago. When one of us says, "Look, there's nothing out there," what we are really saying is, "I cannot see." From here, the White River will flow into the Wabash River, and then into the Ohio, and then into the Great Mississippi River, and then into the Gulf of Mexico. Even after that, it will keep going, freezing, melting, evaporating, raining, flowing, being neither created nor destroyed. Looking out at this river,